Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 18, Lethal White, Under the Magnifying Glass, where we will be talking Cormoran Strike with Beatrice Groves and Louise Freeman. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
You know, I'm really excited about this conversation. I'm a little tired, too. My son got in on an airplane at 2:30 yesterday morning, so I'm kind of out of it. But it's cold here in Oklahoma City, and I'm dying to talk about the murders here.
Yeah. Dying to talk about murder. Well, John, you have definitely been keeping us apprised of all of the best theories about Lethal White on Hogwarts Professor, and our two guests today have definitely been really great contributors to all of those theories and deep readings, and so I'm really excited also to hear more from them. So our special guests today are Dr. Beatrice Groves, Research Fellow in Renaissance English at Oxford University, and Dr. Louise Freeman, Professor of Psychology at Mary Baldwin University. Both Bea and Louise have been talking a lot of Cormoran Strike. They have a lot to tell us, a lot of things that would never have occurred to me, and so I'm excited to even hear more. Welcome to the show, Bea and Louise.
Thank you, Katie. Lovely to be here.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here, too.
All right, let's talk first impressions. How did everybody enjoy this reading experience? This is a big book, right? But J.K. Rowling really it makes a page turner. What did you think as you were first reading it?
I really enjoyed it, and I was delighted that she was scaling back from the horrors of Career of Evil.
Yes, me too.
I thought, where are we going to go after that? And I was delighted to find that we were going to go backwards to a more classic, less gory piece, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I felt the same way. It's an odd word to use with a murder mystery series, but I use the word refreshing. It was the lower body count, the less gruesome factor compared to both Career of Evil and to the Silkworm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Every time I give a Harry Potter talk, I recommend the Cormoran Strike series, and I always qualify that by saying I'm recommending this to the adults in the audience, because, you know, you don't want a 12-year-old who's just finished Deathly Hallows, you know, picking up this next and saying, "Oh, cool." But, you know, this is the first of the series I really felt like I would be comfortable discussing with a teenager. Yes, it's a murder mystery. Yes, it's a pretty gruesome death for poor Mr. Chisel. But just in terms of everything was toned down, not just the violence, but the sexual encounters, the swearing, almost everything that really revved up the adult level on the previous two books was scaled back a little of this in favor of much richer relationships and relationship building and character growth. And I really, really like that.
I agree with that. Is that a sign of that she feels more confident that what she's writing is going to be assumed to be for adults and she doesn't maybe have to put some of those in? Or do you think she's just mixing it up for us?
I think some of both. I mean, I think yes, you can't keep scaling gruesome factor up every time, or you're going to be investigating genocide by book six. You know, this is yeah. So I think a variety, and you just it's harder to focus on the more personal relationships. I mean, does it really matter if your marriage is lousy when there's a guy out running around, you know, slitting the throats of innocent young girls?
Priorities, right? Priorities.
Yeah. Catching the killer is still important, but there was no reason to believe this was a serial killer. And in fact, it is likely there would have been at least two more murders on this by this guy if they had not caught them, but they actually prevented them. It was very exciting for a change, because they didn't do such a hot job of that.
Well, I think I agree with you that I really liked that there was a focus on relationships, and relationship is, in fact, at the heart of the mystery itself. And I didn't say this at the beginning, but listeners should be aware that we are going to spoil everything, so definitely make sure that you have read everything first. But, of course, the murder itself is at the heart of a family drama, and then there's this other mystery that turns out to be sort of on the side. It's a bit tangential, but it's also a family drama, and you really get the sense of relationship being a core issue in all of the things that are happening, not only between Cormoran and Robin, but also in the murder mystery itself.
And I like the way that characters, I was thinking about a recent post on Hogwarts Professor about Rowling's use of understory in Harry Potter, and the way that Freddy, who is dead before it starts, so we don't know anything about him, but he turns out to have been, his 18th birthday party turns out to be the place where two appalling things happen to Rhiannon, Wynn, and also to Raphael, that one of those is deeply connected to the murder. And so Freddy, just sort of, we gradually piece together what a monster he was over the course of the novel without ever meeting him. And that kind of, again, as you say, relationship depths, that sort of sibling rivalry that happened in the past is actually very important psychologically for why Raphael is how he is.
Right, and you call that understory.
Yeah, because what is Freddy Chisel like is not a question that any reader would think to ask themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's there, once you look back, you realise that his actions pin together a lot of important parts of the story.
We were told that right at the beginning, too. I mean, when Cormoran Strike was first talking about investigating his death, he was saying, you know, he never saw someone who you know, he was more convinced his own men had done because he was such a rotten person. So we were told that from the beginning. Kind of had to unfold exactly why. Yeah. And it ends with him shooting the pony. I mean, how worse can you get?
Yeah, just for the Cormoran Strike purists, the Raffaella event does not happen at the 18th birthday. But it is the critical point of the story, and it is about Freddy being a sadist, a miserable brother. I mean, if there's one person that comes out of this book that you're glad is dead, it's Freddy Chisel.
And then you have these objects connected with him, with the money clip and the sword. So he's right. Sort of present in these different these different ways.
In a way, he is the white horse. He's the ghost that haunts this book. Oh well, we'll get to the white horse.
We'll get to that, but I just wanted to say, sort of start off, because I'm really interested in the links of this book with the Ibsen play Rosmersholm, which is begins every single chapter. It begins with an epigraph from Rosmersholm, and there's a dead character in Rosmersholm, Beata, the dead wife. And what you said there, John, about him being the white horse, where it ends with the deaths of the protagonists, and they say, you know, the dead wife has got them, she's pulled them down into the water, and that sense of the sins of the dead person sort of coming through and being crucial to how the narrative plays out, I think is something that's a sort of subtle link with the Ibsen play.
I hope we're gonna get to that. I mean, my gosh, I've listened to that play three times in the last week. But it's you're right. That's the backdrop. The accusation that there's no understory here is not quite spot on. I want to say my reading experience was that, like everything that Rowling writes, I was surprised and delighted. I mean, that's you know, so there's always going to be this. There's things we know that have to happen, and the things that we want to guess happen. And yeah, the things that we have to happen, they, most of them do. And the things that you guess, you're just horribly wrong on. And you're delighted that you're wrong on them, because what you did was much better than you predicted. I mean, it's the knight's move. Everything that you think you know about her, she surprises you with how she fulfills it and how she disappoints you. Anyway.
Yeah. So you've given me a great segue to my next question, John, which is, you know, we did on our episode 14 of Reading, Writing, Rolling, try to predict what Lethal White might have in store for us. So let me ask everybody, how do you think we did? I mean, I think, John, you went through, you know, we had some hits and misses, but overall, how did we do?
I was delighted, actually, because I did much better on this than I have done on either of the previous three books. You know, back actually before even Career of Evil, way back in the Silkworm days, I had done the math and figured out if the time frame stayed the way it was, with each book being 6 to 8 months apart, that the fourth one was going to wind up at the time of the London Olympics, which would be a wonderful match for the sports-oriented Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, where you have the Quidditch World Cup and you have the Triwizard Tournament. You have these big wizard sporting events in the background. Well, let's make Cormoran Strike #4 have the sporting event of the Muggle world in the background. Talked myself out of that, because we were seeing that pre-publicity that said that it was going to pick up right where Career of Evil left off. And so I said, well, that's it. We can't have the Olympics then, unless it jumps forward 1 year. And lo and behold, it jumped forward 1 year. So I was very excited about seeing that pan out, because that was actually a prediction from two books ago. So I thought I'd feel like I get bonus points for that one. The second one that I thought would happen was that there would be some sort of formal ball type event analogous to the Yule Ball of Goblet of Fire, where Robin would finally get to wear that green dress. And that happened as well. So I was very happy about those two things.
When I read it, Louise, I thought, my goodness, the Olympics is, you know, that guess has come true beyond what you could possibly have imagined, to have, you know, the main character being someone who's organizing the Olympics. I thought, wow. So that one came out in spades. So I was really impressed by that.
I want to jump in here and say that to give B the award for best bullseye, in that I spent a good part, better part of 10 days laying out all of the Lethal White possibilities and the White Horse possibilities, and only mentioned as an aside, because other people forced me into it, to talk about the White Horse of Uffington. B went on at some length about the White Horse of Uffington and said that that has to be inside this book. And not only was it a feature of the story, but I think B was... Tell the story about where you were reading the book.
Yes, so I was really hopeful that the White Horse at Uffington would turn out to be the place, would be a major part of the White Horse imagery. And I wrote a post on MuggleNet about that. And I thought, I must go back. I haven't been to the White Horse for ages, and I live near it. So I thought, I'll go back. I'll go on publication day, and I'll take the book with me, and I'll go and read it beside the White Horse at Uffington. So I had a fantastic walk up there. It's beside the Ridgeway, which is, in fact, the oldest road in England, which is quite cool. So I walked along that, and then I sat down beside the White Horse, and I read Lethal White. And, in fact, it was an incredibly windy day, so I couldn't read it for very long. It kept blowing away. So I thought, okay, I'll go to the local pub. And there were two pubs, and someone said to me, oh, you must go to the Horse and Hounds. And then I saw the other pub was called the White Horse, so I thought, I really ought to go to that one. So I went in and I read it there. And then, as you know, if you read it, then Robin and Cormoran walk into that pub in Lethal White. And so I felt very, very happy when that happened. And I thought, I've done a pre-fan pilgrimage. And has anyone ever done a pre-fan pilgrimage?
Right. That's a unique experience.
I do think it probably is, because only Rowling really gives you hints before things come out that you could piece together and guess. So that was, I did a little sort of, you know, air punch when I got to that bit. I was very happy. And she doesn't mention Uffington. I don't know if you noticed that, but in case people might spot that, she says the house is in Wollstone. And because I'd just been there, I knew that that was, in fact, the nearby village. That there is an Uffington as well, but she mentions the Chisel House as being in Wolston so that people can't kind of guess about the Uffington White Horse before she wants them to. But having just been there, I thought, oh, I know where that is. So I knew I'd got it right when I got to the Chisel House in Wolston, so I was very happy.
Katie, besides that extraordinary bullseye, it was like B was reading over Rolling Shoulder. We had a scorecard. I had 17 things that had to happen in the book that were like what her previous Corman Strike things, and that was an 82% hit rate. You know, the murder was going to be revealed in the central chapter. There'd be epigraphs or something by Catullus, the profanity. Matt and Robin, the leg issues, the news media, all those things, happen.
And Charlotte Ross coming back in.
That's right.
Yeah.
The only air balls that we had were problems with the Met, that she turned that upside down. We didn't get any Lita backstory. That was a disappointment. And then there's, in the previous books, Corman Strug has had sex, he finds a body, and the police interrogate him. It's sort of like, Corman doesn't have, you know, good luck. Well, maybe he has great luck with women, but he always finds a dead body immediately afterwards. It's almost like a Victorian formula. It's Robin who pushes off her husband, who really is a sexual assault after the ball, the Paralympians reception. And the next day she finds the body and is interrogated by the police. And so we have a little bit of a flip at the center, but. The only thing that I missed on with the swags, you know, the wild guesses. We did get the cuckoo echoes. We did get the goblet echoes. The white horses we got, and the P.D. James echo. There was a lot of P.D. James in this book, with the manor house and the family in decline, etc. But Ropey doesn't appear. We don't get the confused dates. The birthdays didn't happen. We didn't get the heroine. I really wanted the heroine to be in there. No heroine. She worked the formula. The formula things worked out, but she wasn't predictable.
Yeah, I like your point about the flip, and the Met was very much a flip. That it's very unusual to have stories with private eyes where the Met suddenly becomes terribly helpful and lets them in on the end. And that was, that was really nice.
But it also had to work that way because of the big confrontation at the finish. You know, it did have me saying, wait a minute, where's Strike in his office screaming, you know, profanely about these idiot policemen that he has to reveal what's really wrong with this, you know, how the case works out. Nothing like that at the end of Fleetful White.
You mentioned the P.D. James echoes, John, and I got that very strongly when Robin had a little moment where she walked off, I don't know if you remember, where she walks off into a graveyard and sits on her own and walks past these sort of corbels, you know, some sort of decorated stone headings. And I just sort of thought, this is a very P.D. James moment, actually. And it was funny. It was the strongest time I've ever had of sort of thinking that sort of homage to the woman alone in the sort of gothic setting within the city, sort of finding the little gothic areas within the modern world. It's very close parallel, I thought.
And, you know, if we're thinking about some of the, you know, some of the parallels, John, you've emphasized that there's a pattern in how the Strike books are unfolding compared with the Harry Potter series. And, you know, thinking about book four of Strike compared with Goblet of Fire, book four of Harry Potter. And we've talked about, you know, Louise's great prediction, you know, that the Olympics, we have this big sporting event that figures, and of course things going wrong with that event and corruption associated with that event. What are some of the other connections that we can see, that if it's the center of the story, if it's the seven book series, what else do we see connecting it to Goblet of Fire?
You know, I've been the proponent of this parallel series idea, but I confess that I've held it at just enough arm's length so I can run away from it.
Very wise.
But after Goblet of Fire, I think I'm gonna pull this pretty close to my chest because for example, Evan Willis, who's a University of Dallas wizard, he said that as he was reading the story, knowing the goblet was in the background, as soon as he read that there was a minister of culture and a minister of sport, knew exactly that the minister of culture was going to die and that his son was going to kill him.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I didn't catch up on that until it happened, but yes, as soon as it was obvious by the end of it. Oh yes, this is Barty Crouch all over again. The low level, not too likable government minister who's in charge of pulling off these games gets murdered by his son. I mean, that's pretty straight.
That's a pretty big bullseye. We have Spew echoed by Core. We have bugging. We have the romance backdrop. We have a big graveyard scene. We have the big save at the finish. We've got Potter panic attacks throughout Goblet of Fire, which are paralleled by, of course, Robbins. Winky is like Izzy. We got the blackmail subplot there. One of my favorite things is just this: the word echoes. For example, the word enervate is used twice and incorrectly by rolling in Goblet as a spell. You know, to revive someone, you yell, you know, go to sleep at them, enervate. You know, but she uses the word enervating. Robin and Harry are constantly saying I'm fine when they're not fine. There's eyes like cats that are watching the main hero. There's the repeated nightmare experience. There's a super injunction in both books against the press revealing what's really going on. the phrase that old cow, don't stay after dark. There's an arm scar. I mean, if you notice that everybody has an arm scar now, Harry gets his arm scar in the graveyard scene at Goblet. Robin and Corman are both sporting arm scars from their experience in previous books. Huh. I mean, seriously, I think Rowling, I was thinking about Lev Grossman, who wrote once about how he plotted out one of the Magician's novels by saying, I want to have a dragon in here. I want to go to Venice. He wrote himself a little checklist of things he wanted to include. I think Rowling may have sat down with Goblet of Fire and said, okay, here are, you know, 50 plot points that I want to roll into this story. You know, okay, Sirius complains about Azkaban. I want to have Raphael talk about jail time. You know what I mean? And we go back and forth with these parallels. It gets to be almost a comedy.
Another one I hadn't caught on until I hadn't thought about until just recently, John, was, you know, you had the split with Harry and Ron at the beginning of Goblet of Fire when, you know, their misunderstanding. You had that split between Robin and Cormoran.
Painful split.
Very painful split that had to get healed before the story can move along.
I was listening to Lethal just last night, and there's the scene where he's at the bedside of, or he's calling Robin to talk to her about what's going on with Jack, and I started to cry. The only scene in all of Harry Potter that makes me, well, there's two, there's that death of Dobby, but the big one that makes me cry all the time is the reunion of Harry and Ron after the first Triwizard task. Where the Granger runs out of the tent screaming, you know, she's you two are, and Ron says completely bonkers. But I cry at that scene every time, and I cry whenever Cormoran starts to cry, which is only when he's talking to his partner, whom he obviously loves, about Jack's appendicitis.
Just going back to Barty Crouch as well, I think the fact that Raphael goes to prison and that his father is kind of, you know, completely cold about that. He mentions a number of times that he never visits him in prison, and obviously Barty Crouch Senior sends Barty Crouch Junior to prison, so that's another parallel there.
And even more on that, that's a great catch, B, is that they get out early, right? Yeah. The father pulls the strings. It's hard to pull strings of Azkaban, but he gets them out of there early, and it doesn't work out well for him that he gets him out of prison. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bad idea. Yeah, and how interesting that Izzy, you made the connection between Izzy and Winky, the house elf. Of course, I picked up on the house elf comment that you made there. And she's the one who goes and visits Raphael in prison, and she's kind of enabling him in a lot of the story as well, serving a similar role.
Well, I thought Izzy was more like Barty Crouch's mother in terms of, you know, the mother is the one, of course, who actually is the one pushing to get him out and takes his place when she's about to die, and that thing like that. I kept thinking about so you had Flick and you had Keegan.
Yeah,
so you had two kind of female servants who kind of split the role of Winky to me in terms of, you know, they're the ones who ultimately spill all the secrets and say, okay, yes, this is how it happened. And they were, you know, the witnesses to what was going on. And so I saw them as more of the Winky parallels rather than Izzy.
Katie, to sort of hijack this question, one of the fun things about Goblet, of course, is that it's the pivot of the seven book series.
Yes.
And we couldn't have known that the seven book series was going to be a ring until you get to Goblet, and it has all the echoes that it does of Philosopher's Stone. You get to Lethal White, and because of the Goblet parallels all playing out, we had to look at Cuckoo's Calling to see if Lethal White also had echoes of Cuckoo's Calling. And there are a surfeit of echoes of Cuckoo's Calling. You've got the, first of all, the murder, which is you know, offered as a suicide to the police who accept it. There's the batshit insane relative of the deceased who sort of pushes the investigation. You basically get at the center of Lethal White the opening to Cuckoo's Calling. There are the redheads that you mentioned. We've got redheads galore in both books. It goes on and on. There's the mental illness backdrop of Rochelle Amalfate and of Billy Knight. You got the Polish cleaning woman. I mean, how many Polish cleaning women can there be in literature? You've got Oedipal jealousy. You've got Jack's bellyache. I mean, Jack gets shot in the belly. Jack shoots Cormoran in the belly in Cuckoo's Calling. And then, of course, we get the reverse echo with Jack having an appendix attack. And something that I think Louise got was the she pointed out to me that it was a very important issue in Lethal White is Cormoran going through all of his nightmare experiences as a young man. Talks about this commune in Norfolk, and Strike goes into that again in Lethal White. So we're pretty sure to see that in Book 7, a trip to that commune.
Yeah, so I was wondering if this is because you expect it, we can connect it obviously to the book that already exists, but can we use what we know now from Cuckoo's Calling and Lethal White to maybe anticipate what the seventh book would look like?
I had one guess, which is the Leda murder, that we've had, you know, a relative's death looking like suicide turning out to be murder in 1 and 4. So that then should be Leda's apparent overdose that Strike. So that's my guess for 7.
Yeah, Bee's bullseye there is to suggest that it is a seven book series. Rowling has done everything but taken out ads in major newspapers saying it is not a seven book series. All the structure is screaming that yes, it is, and we will have Leda's seeming suicide explained as a murder in the last book. One funny thing, and we don't know if this is just a publisher's error, though that would be extraordinary, is that the pivot of the book is labeled with a page that says part 2 right in the center of this novel. But there is no page at the beginning that says part 1. That suggests that part 2 has begun at the center of the fourth book, which means that we're going to, and sure enough, we start off in the second part of part 2, as I said, with a parallel set of circumstances. You know, the relative comes to Strike and says, I can't believe it's a suicide, it must have been a murder, and he says, no, I can't take this case, the med has looked at this case. So, yeah, he does the exact opening to Cuckoo's Calling right in the center of the fourth book.
And so you're saying it's not part 2 of book 4, it's part 2 of the whole series.
Exactly. We have a missing page mystery. And that missing page mystery suggests that no matter what she says, there may be books 8, 9, and 10. She may do another seven book series. Who knows? But the structure is all screaming that the story arc that we started with the first scenes of Cuckoo's Calling are going to play out at the finish of Strike 7.
Wow.
Well, in that sense, John, it may be a good thing that you know, Rokeby didn't appear on scene as the great Voldemort villain of the series in this book then, because then we'd have to dispose of him in book 7, and then, you know, where do you go from there? You go to, you know, what do you do after you've gotten rid of Voldemort? Yeah, there's not much else you can do, as, you know, the difficulties with Cursed Child showed.
19 years later.
So, given if there isn't going to be that big Voldemort, Moriarty, whatever type of opponent that Cormoran will ultimately have to defeat, then there's room for doing a 7-book arc and then going on and doing another 7-book arc if you want to, which, this is fine with me. I'll keep reading it. I thought that was sort of interesting. So maybe the whole Johnny Rokeby prediction not coming to pass is a good thing.
Yeah, I agree. And Katie, to answer your question, we don't know that much about book 7, other than that maybe someone's going to get shot in the head, and that's why we have these redheads that appear in books 1 and 4.
We've
set the stage to be afraid of Strike 5. Because Order of the Phoenix is certainly the most depressing book in young adult literature's canon. we're looking at another career of evil, I'm afraid, where we're going to be shocked and surprised at how depraved and crazy things can get. I think in terms of that things aren't going to work out in a rosy, happy fashion with Robin and Cormoran.
Things have to get worse before they can get better. And there's all the emotional intensity of book 5 as well.
John, do you think that fits with like book 5 being a black Negrito alchemy type thing?
Yes. Charlotte comes back. We've got Charlotte back on the scene. We didn't get the big Rokeby reveal in the graveyard, you know, sort of a la Lord Voldemort, but we did get the plotting, revenge focused mad woman to appear, and Charlotte on stage was at least, if we couldn't get Johnny Rokeby, it was a delight to have Charlotte back on hand, because she is one evil woman, and she is going to do every, she's going to weaponize Matt, she's going to weaponize every bad guy and family we've seen so far in the series, and they're all going to come to make Robin and Cormoran's life miserable. And they've made themselves vulnerable enough in Goblet of Fire because of all the things that they did there.
You mean Lisa White?
Goblet of Fire. Lisa White, John. Goblet of Fire.
They're the same book. I refuse to be corrected on this. They're the same book. Goblet of Fire 2, I should say. You know, Son of Goblet of Fire. I'm afraid about Strike 5. It's not going to be the relatively delightful trip where we get Robin and Cormoran on the verge talking about their parallel needs for each other, basically, you know, mutual therapy. That was such a heartwarming moment. That don't look for that in Strike 5.
You're shattering my hopes. But that's okay. Yeah, I know it has to get worse before it can resolve. We've got 3 more books. So, all right, let's talk about naming. B, you have told us before about how J.K. Rowling likes to use cratylic names, kind of in that Dickensian sense, I suppose, of names, you know, having alternate meanings or references that they're playing off of. Let's talk about some of the naming that J.K. Rowling is doing in Lethal White and its significance.
John has got a great post about this on Hogwarts Professor, and one of the ones I really liked was Rhiannon, which is a name. So she's Rhiannon Wynne, and Wynne is the Welsh for white from Gwyn, and that fits in very well with Della's personification as whiter than white. But it also links that with Rhiannon as a possible sort of Celtic horse goddess related character from Welsh mythology. And I thought, oh, that's really nice that we've got a white horse coming in again. That one's a bit of a red herring, that white horse, because she's not actually the reason for the murder, but it was a nice way of bringing the white horse in to a different part of the plot with Rhiannon Wynne. So I thought that was a great one.
And Louise, you had a fantastic one with the dog Rattenberry, the terrier.
Yes, that was just a fluke. I thought that was, you know, compared to the other dog Badger, that was a very, you know, aristocratic sounding name, and you know there was an interesting contrast between the two. And of course, you know, anytime a Harry Potter fan sees the word badger, it's like, ah, Hufflepuff, and you've got a black lab and you've got a yellow lab. No, you look up Rattenberry, and turns out I had not heard of this person before, but apparently Francis Rattenberry was a very famous murder victim of the 1930s who was a well-known architect in the British upper class who dumped his wife for a much younger woman who was of... She was actually a performer, a singer-songwriter, so... you know, not of the blue blood that he would expect to be with, and he kind of fell from polite society after taking up with this younger woman. He lost his fortune through bad business decisions, just like Mr. Chisel. They had been in Canada where he'd been designing his very famous buildings, and then they went back to England. After they got back to England, his now much younger wife that he has, his trophy wife he has taken up with, in turn finds her own younger lover. She takes up with their 17-year-old chauffeur, a man by the name of George Stoner, just like Canerva took up with the much younger Raphael after, you know, being the one that, one of the ones that she wasn't the younger woman that Chisel eventually dumped his first wife for, but she was much younger and not well received by the family. And anyway, Rattenberry winds up dead from being pounded in the head with a hammer.
Like
Chisel. Chisel wasn't killed that way, but he did get attacked with the hammer. Both the wife, Alma, and George Stoner were tried jointly for the murder. Alma wound up being acquitted, but George was sentenced to hang, although in a kind of a Rowling-esque twist, Alma goes off and kills herself. She feels apparently so guilty about the fact that her younger lover is going to hang for this that she goes off and stabs herself and then throws herself into the river.
Oh my gosh.
And then Stoner himself, it turns out there's a public outcry. People are rather outraged that this young man is going to be hanged because they feel he was seduced by this, you know, evil older woman. So he winds up getting his sentence commuted, winds up actually getting released to go serve in the war. His war service winds up free. So anyway, but you've got all these very common elements. I think if you had... You know, he was talking about as soon as he saw that he was the minister in charge of the Olympics, he was going to be killed by his son. If you had looked up the name Rattenberry, as she said, he was Jasper's dog. Well, it turns out this is kind of Jasper's story. He, you know, gets bumped off by his wife's much younger lover, who is a son rather than a servant, but.
Wow, what a story that is. That's an amazing find.
When I saw that name, I said, okay, this can't be coincidence. There are way too many links here.
I also really like, Louise, that we often have Kinvara keep saying, oh, do shut up, Rattenberry. Shout at him. Oh, yeah. Shut up, Rattenberry. I said, don't tell them who thought the story is.
It reminds me of the old Lassie movies. I think Lassie is trying to tell us something. Rattenberry. Look up Rattenberry's story.
There's the names thing. The Dickensian cryptonym, the Cretilic names, whatever we're going to call this, Rowling's borderline obsession with names plays out in Lethal White. My three favorites, as B mentioned, I've written a very long post on all the names, and there's still more to go. We haven't gotten them all. What my favorite, I think, is Vanessa Equenzi. She's a black police officer in the Met.
And Robin's friend.
Robin's close friend.
Robin's first friend. Yay!
Yay, finally. Yeah. for Nolikoff fans, that was just hilarious that we get the black Vanessa, because that's in probably Nabokov's the critical consensus is that Pale Fire is his best book, and The Black Vanessa is the butterfly that is John Shade's daughter, it reincarnated. It tries to talk to him, his dead daughter Hazel. So the Red Admirable, it comes back and talks to him. So it's or tries to and fails. So The Black Vanessa is one scene where Robin escapes Matt, the flubberworm, as Louise likes to call him, for the porch, and saying it's Vanessa, and she goes out on the porch, and there's a butterfly, or actually a moth, trying to get inside, and Robin has this conversation with Strike, who's seemingly Vanessa, who's trying to tell him, you know, there's things going on. That, again, for Nabokov fan, that's a lot of fun. Probably much more important is Lorelei Bevan, because of Anurin Bevan, and B, please correct me, I've never heard Anurin pronounced. I've only read that.
Anurin.
Anurin. That sounds a little bit like urology, but I'm going to go with that. Anurin Bevan, who is the founder of the National Health Service in the United Kingdom, very much lionized as a hero, though a communist fellow traveler. I have to throw that little note in. But the NHS is throughout this book, health services declined, accepted, unavailable. There's this constant reference to the NHS from the first core meeting to notes about Jimmy Knight saying we need to stop building missiles so we have more money for hospitals, to the right side saying the NHS is Chisel just thinks the NHS isn't something we don't want to talk about. His daughter takes the same tack in the second half of the book. The NHS is the subplot that goes through the whole thing, and medical services in the United Kingdom. That Lorelei has this name, though, is important because it highlights that Strike uses women basically for his comfort and convenience. For his, he goes to Lorelei Bevan when he has his biggest physical breakdown inside the story, is that she serves as the NHS to him. That women do that, and that's sort of the tragedy of the pairing inside the books, is that Strike uses and abuses women sexually. I mean, he's not a sexual assailant, but he only uses women for convenience to cover up his agonies about his failed relationship with Charlotte and his longing for Robin. And Robin, in a marriage, you know, hates her husband, that we have this, and yet she obliges him sexually. Says that there's one chapter pairing where Robin tells her husband that she loves him when she doesn't, and she knows she doesn't, and she's lying. And then Strike tells his girlfriend, who tells him that she loves him, and he won't say the words. And you know that complimentary agony that they're going through, it can only be resolved when they finally will say to each other that they love each other. We'll get that, I'm afraid, in book 7. But back to Lorelei Bevan. Well, that's John, highlighted by the fact that she's the medical person for him.
So John, you're making me think about, you know, the beginning of the book. Like, I wonder if all that stuff with the wedding was mostly just to get the swan imagery in, which we start the book with and then we end the book with, but it's very much about pairings. At the very beginning, the photographer can't get the swans together in the picture with Matthew and Robin, and it's only once Robin starts to march off that the two swans start to move together. And so that brings me to some questions about swans and mythology, because I know that you all have talked about some of the mythic references that are coming through the Strike series in general. And once again, we see a lot of that in Lethal White. So help me out. What's going on with these swans and twins, all these pairs?
Well, here we have to mention Joanne Gray and Evan Willis, who have really taken this subject to heights that I never could have taken it. And they've posted a Hogwarts professor about this. They've drilled the Castor Pollux connection with Robin and Cormoran, and how the Leda and this Leda and the Swans, the legend of Leda and the Swans. Leda, the queen of Sparta, has twins, both Helen of Troy and Clytemnestra, and Castor and Pollux. I'll let Louise explain the genetics, which still escapes me, of that event. But
it's again, mythology. Yeah, easy
explanation. There you go. That's right. It's not okay. Really, and Lethal White plays out on that. I should say to Evan Willis, very much against the grain of the flow at my website, was saying there was no way that Ropey was going to appear in book four. He will only appear at the wedding at the finish. And he made that prediction because of what he calls the hermetic presence of Ropey. And that's sort of the bracketing of the swans in the story, because not only do the swans open the book, but they close the book in stone where Robin notes them as she walks away from Strike. And we see, to your point about the swans being Robin and Cormoran, and about their relationship, it's also that Robin only sees swans in the rest of the book in a pub sign where there's a single swan. There's no paired swans until the end. We do get the very pregnant woman in the beginning. The book, not too surprisingly, is a ring composition. Surprise! But we get the twins. We get the very pregnant woman at the reception. Then we get the woman pregnant with twins, associated with Strike, Charlotte, and her twins at the dead center of what I believe is the central book of the series. That will play out not only in the finish with the twin swans, but it will play out in the final book. We'll find out about Leda and the swan.
I also think there are all these kind of godlike references to Cormoran that suggest he's a sort of semi-divine figure, and his celebrity that's been magnified now by the time we're in Lethal White, I think, kind of emphasizes that part too.
That's wonderful, Katie. We do get, when he's talking about his time with Lorelei in the sack, he talks about her being Aphrodite to his being Hephaestus. We get that reference to Della Wynn, the sort of the blind seer from Delphi, I guess. I mean, there's always that backdrop to her work, which is mythic.
I'd say that the white horses from the Ibsen, obviously, are sort of a different kind of mythology, sort of a Norse mythology. And I thought, as when with looking always for Harry Potter references, I wonder if she's liked this Ibsen play for a long time, because they are death omens, which obviously we're thinking about the Grimm and the Black Dog as kind of a different folk mythology for a death omen
or
to a
thestrals.
White horse, but related. Yeah.
Thestrals, you can only see them when you've witnessed death.
That's right. And the white horses are not death omens in a simple way. In Rosalind. And one way they do work a bit like a thestral, and in one way they work a bit like a Grimm. So there is a bit where you know, they see the horses and then they know someone's going to die, and sure enough, Rebecca and Rosma do die after Rebecca's seen the white horse.
But it's wonderful you mentioned that, because in relationship to Katie's questions about the swans, because the bracketing in Rosma's home is the play really starts off with conversation about the white horses, and there's reference to them throughout the play. Again, there's a Hogwarts Professor post just on that. But the end, the maid sees a white horse as they're about to go off the mill race. That there's bracketing of the white horses the way there is with the white swans inside Lethal White. Are we segueing to Rosmere's home?
Let's talk about that. She uses it as the epigraph at the beginning of every chapter, and I guess we've moved on from Blue Oyster Cult from Career of Evil to Ibsen.
Yeah, exactly. We're back to Silkworm, which had, again, very high culture epigraphs to early modern plays. I don't know, and I would love it if anyone did know and commented on this, but I don't know of any other book ever which has used the same book for every epigraph. Right. I think this is the greatest sort of, as it were, homage to another book, which any book has ever done. It's extraordinary to have 71 quotes from Rosma Scholm turning up in Lethal White.
How much of the play is there even left to read after that?
Yeah, there actually still is a lot of play, but yeah, it is quite extraordinary. I also think that when you have this Ibsen play being so foregrounded, you start thinking other Ibsen plays. And the most famous Ibsen, I'd say, in England, or at least the one you'd likely to have met at school or, you know, as a younger person, is The Doll's House, A Doll's House. Mm-hmm. And so when I saw Ibsen being foregrounded, I thought, excellent, Robin is leaving Matthew. We are going to see that happen.
Oh, yeah.
And it also is quite similar, because I don't know if anyone else thought this, but I thought, you know, why does Robin stay in the house to tell him she's leaving him? She should just leave a note and just say, you know, I'm not bothering with this. And obviously one reason is because she wants to underline that Matthew is unacceptable by the way he responds to her. But I also think it makes it much more Doll's House to have her saying that in the house and then going out and slamming the door. And that the sort of the leaving of Nora in A Doll's House is very famous. And I think this is probably stretching it too far, but I did wonder whether that door that doesn't shut, remember, that's one of the clues, the chisel, I thought, oh yeah, that kind of leaks through, which is quite satisfying.
Yeah, you don't need to go to Doll's House. I mean, the Rosmare's Home, as you said, is a unique experience in that it's throughout the book. If you listen to the play over and over again, it's fun to see how they pull these tiny pieces out that have nothing to do with their corresponding places inside the play. But she must have gone through that thing with a comb to find these phrases that happen to match the chapter thing. But the correspondences are really just over the top. You've got a twofold blackmail going on from the left side and the right side that parallels what happens to White.
Just to say, follow up on that one, John, I think the political message of the two is quite similar. So she's finding Ibsen was horrified by both the far left and the far right of where politics was going at his time. And that is very much mapped out onto Lethal White.
Yeah, that it promises death, that basically this idealistic man, some remnant of, you know, this Nordic Christianity, is obliterated by this political fight. But the parallels are unreal. You've got the mystery of Beata's suicide, which is sort of like Rhiannon's suicide that overhangs this book. We've got the overheard conversations that Rebecca West, you know, overhears what's going on, that where she learns how Rosmare is being blackmailed by his supposed friends and his enemy. There's the son betraying the father for Kroll. We've got newspaper attacks, the fear of both sides weaponizing the newspapers. There's the family secret being kept, which is, I mean, there's really a big reveal that's just beneath the surface that I don't know, understand how anybody can watch that play and get it the first time. That Rebecca West, she finds out what her backstory is in the middle of the play, which upsets everything. And it's so subtly done that I wonder how this works on the stage, because to pick up that not only was she sleeping with her foster father, but that her foster father was actually her biological father, so it was an incestuous.
Oh my gosh!
That is what overturns everything in the play, which is exactly Raphael's plan. They use the older man or woman to manipulate the victim into murder suicide. That's exactly what happens to Beata and Chisel.
I think that sort of Oedipal underpinning in Lethal White, when I found, you know, read Rosma Scholm and found the incest in it, I thought, I think that sort of, obviously, you know, sleeping with your stepmother, I've looked it up, it's not actually illegal, which I'm slightly surprised by, but it is clearly considered incestuous by modern, you know, it's very much frowned upon. So that there is sort of literal incest going on in the Ibsen play, I thought was sort of brought that out really, really nicely.
See, I like your connection to The Doll's House too, because I hadn't thought about that before, but, you know, there's that wonderful moment in The Doll's House where, you know, Torvald is saying, I can't believe it, you know, you don't love me anymore.
Absolutely. He's so masculine, isn't he?
The wife says, yeah, that's right, buddy, I don't love you anymore. Yeah. And, you know, Robin pretty much does the same thing.
And but the stifling of him as, you know, his sort of sense that this is what a traditional marriage looks like and that should be enough for her, and totally unaware that it isn't. And he also breaks down in tears when she leaves, again, sort of completely unable to comprehend why she could be leaving him. And I thought, yeah, Matthew and Torvald is a very close parallel. Yeah.
But also, the other parallel, of course, you know, what had gotten Nora in trouble in the first place was when her husband got critically ill and she forged his signature.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
And of course, you know, had Matthew not gotten that seaborne bacteria in the on the
escaped.
Honeymoon, she would have escaped much earlier too. So you had this critical illness and the wife, you know, kind of nursing him through this and then getting trapped is a very similar theme. And then she winds up leaving at the end. I think I've never actually read Brummer's Home Flame. I'm going to have to add that to my list.
V, one of the things that you had said in your book, Literary Illusion in Harry Potter, is that one of the things J.K. Rowling is doing with her books is directing you to other books she wants you to read.
It seems
like, I mean, it's very clear she wants us to read Rosmer's Home, but maybe she wants us to read other Ibsen too. You know, I'm teaching A Doll's House this semester, but it never occurred to me until you mentioned that. What a great and perfect connection that is. Louise, I'm with you. Rosmer's Home is on my Kindle. I will be reading it. So nobody's downloaded it for years.
Hedda Gabler now too.
There's two things more about Rosmer's Home before we go into all of Ibsen. It is one, the white horses. The play was originally called White Horses, believe it or not. It's not until like the second or third draft that he changes it to Rosmer's Home. And as B said earlier, it's not just a death omen. And in fact, this one author I found, Katie Cross, says that Ibsen said that it represents the inability of characters to deal with memories that haunt them. And that race basically is what's going on in Lethal White, is that, you know, Robin is dealing with all these panic attacks about her history. And Strike is haunted not only by Lita, but by his recovery from his IED explosions. This is a very big deal. But she's also rewriting Rosmer's Home. There's the final scene has Rebecca West ready to walk out. She's packed up and ready to go. She's going to leave, you know, Rosmer to go off for her own life. Try to deal with her. You know, she's just been hit with this realization that she's an incestuous daughter, and he stops her and convinces her basically to jump into the mill race and die. Well, we have that same scene where Robin's all packed up and is being confronted by Matt, and she's got to stay and talk it out. And she says, "Forget about it." You know, she gets a ride and she leaves. She departs. This is her way of saying there could have been a happy ending to Rosmer's Home, and it didn't have to end this way. That Rebecca West could have survived.
It's so good the way it is. There's another sort of murder plot link with Rosmer's Home, which is the painting, obviously, with the reason for the murder in Lethal White. So the setting out stage direction of Rosmer's Home, it tells you about all these paintings of sort of past members of the family, august people looking down on Rosmer and keeping him sort of faithful to the old family traditions, and the Chisel House is very much like that, but it draws your attention to the paintings and the importance of the paintings. And I also wondered if that was another little link back to Harry Potter again. I sort of liked the idea that paintings sort of unexpectedly important in Harry Potter, and they do tell you things about the past, and Schwartz's history is all encoded in its paintings. So I thought that was a nice try connection between the three texts. I also think that something Rowling does in Harry Potter is look for high culture references to her sort of detective world. So the way in which she wants you to work out plots and detective literature is not very highly thought of. And one of the links I found in Harry Potter was with Emma, which I think works in that kind of detective way while being a totally literary text. And I think Rosmer's Home is like that too. So Rosmer's Home has these big reveals. The incest is the main one, but also the fact that Rebecca is basically guilty for Beata's death. So it's kind of a murder. It's a persuasion to suicide rather than a murder, but it's pretty close. And Rosmer's Home is generally considered by Ibsen critics to be one of his, or possibly his greatest play, because of the way in which the structure plays out. So the way in which there's such subtlety, and as John said, you know, you wouldn't necessarily spot it on a first viewing or reading. And I think that works. You know, it's again a sort of high culture reference for how structure and a sort of detective style unfolding of clues can work.
Yeah, this is Rowling's master technique. If there's one thing you have to get in J.K. Rowling, is that there's a text inside the text, that somebody is writing a story that the characters have to figure out while we figure out how they figure out the story. And Rosmer's Home is exactly that. I mean, it's a murder mystery. How do we find out that Rebecca West effectively murdered her hostess, the matron of Rosmer's Home? We find that out by this slow, steady reveal, where characters at the beginning are all confident they know everything that's happened and everybody's happy and all is great. By the end of the story, of course, they're throwing themselves into the mill race. That's a detective fiction thing, but it works at such a high level, and that she is going there here again makes me afraid for book seven. I'm not sure Strike is going to survive book seven, because that the suicide that we're going to figure out is his mother's, that haunts his whole life, I'm afraid is a pointer. And especially as B and I have said, this is such an unusual thing to have these every single epigraph from the same book. We have a suicide that winds up haunting the characters until they commit suicide as well. That doesn't bode well for the finish of book seven.
Well, I'm going to hold out hope. I'm a romantic. I believe J.K. Rowling is a romantic at heart. I think everybody's going to, like, not everybody's going to survive, but I think Robin and Cormac are going to survive. I'm keeping that in my heart. It's my expectation. Now, you were talking about J.K. Rowling and her wonderful plotting. The movie Crimes of Grindelwald, our next Fantastic Beasts movie, is out, and it has not necessarily been warmly received by critics, who find actually some of the plotting of it problematic, but it's the second of probably five movies. What might be some things she's writing Crimes of Grindelwald, you know, in some connection with the time when she's writing Lethal White, right? So what might be some of the connections that we would bring from the movie Crimes of Grindelwald to Lethal White?
You were talking earlier about the symbolism of the swans, and I certainly felt the way the symbolism of the ravens was coming in Crimes of Grindelwald.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, yeah, she's thinking black and white birds. Yeah, she's got that on the brain. There's also some tiny things, but one was fame. So obviously the first line of Lethal White proper is, such is the universal desire for fame that those who achieve it accidentally or unwillingly will wait in vain for pity. And I just noticed that little moment when the Portkey tout raises the price for the trip across the channel and says, price of fame, pal, to Newt. And I thought, oh yeah, you're still, you know, her interest in fame is obviously much stronger. We see it much more in Strike and in Harry Potter, but it's coming through a little bit here. John just mentioned these books within books, and there's a tiny, tiny one of those. There's a really important one in Crimes of Grindelwald, which is the predictions of Tycho Dodonis. But there's also a tiny one. Yeah, so I think that's really important. But there's a tiny, tiny one, which is that we know that Tina has read Newt's book, because when he says, you've got eyes like water through flame, she says, like a salamander. And it's like, he wrote that in his book. So she's read it. I thought that was really nice.
And she knows how to use the little...
She's memorized it.
She knows how to use the little kitty toy with the kappa also, which I thought was delightful.
She's seeing it in action. But yeah, the prediction, the Tycho's book within a book, I think that might turn out to be a sort of... It's not going to be quite as important as the Bombyx Morian Silkworm, but I think it's still going back to that book within a book that we saw most strongly in Silkworm.
The interior text that I'm talking about are not just the books that show up or the stories that people are talking about, but that characters are writing a story inside the story. And so, like, Raphael has written the story that Strike and Robin have to figure out. You know, how he murdered his father and made it look like a suicide, all the things that lead up to that, how he's been planning that for months. That's his narrative that he's trying to sell. And they have to figure out how it doesn't really show up, how it doesn't correspond with reality. Inside Crimes of Grindelwald, it's Grindelwald that's running the text. He basically has got this whole plan to get Credence Aurelius that he's going to sell the Aurelius story to. And people are all upset about, you know, the fact that he's a Dumbledore. That's not the fact he's a Dumbledore. That's Grindelwald's tale that he's selling. We have no idea whether he's really a Dumbledore. None of the times seem to match up, of course. But that's the story that he's written that everybody else has to deal with. And it's very clear that he's written it. He tells the person, let this story begin. Give him the message to have him so he'll come to us. You know, and he lays all that. He leaves a breadcrumb trail for Credence to follow to bring him to him so we get a different ending than we got in New York City. That's the story inside the story that I think Rowling is really trying to get us to alert to, that people tell stories about themselves. They oftentimes are deceptive, not only to others, but to themselves. But here it's definitely a malevolent character that's trying to deceive, murder, do all sorts of things.
But she's also interested in these written, so obviously I agree with you, but it's also these prophecies. So you definitely get this very strong sense of the way in which the prophecy acts in Phoenix. We're getting that same sense with this now written prophecy and whether Voldemort's belief in that prophecy harmed him, and does, you know, has Grindelwald also fallen for something in his belief of who Credence is, or is he just making it up, or is it true? But the way at the moment, one of the criticisms of Crimes of Grindelwald is it's just too episodic and there's too many different people doing different things. But I wonder if karma and these predictions of Tycho Didonis might link up with the Credence story, because we've obviously got these birds, these phoenixes, these ravens, and these are both sort of prophetic birds, and there's all this prophecy based on birds and bird entrails. And you think that I feel that these two could definitely come together in some later. So it's make a more satisfying narrative if they join up.
There's the theme of redemption. Raphael brings it up explicitly inside the book. Do you believe in redemption? Now, here's a character that has not been redeemed. He's flat out evil. But he brings up the story of redemption, and that's something that Robin and Cormoran, that's their whole story arc. Are they going to be able to recover this? Are they going to be like the Thatcher statue, having an influence over this other statue to make it turn green? Can it bring it back to the right color? That look for their return to good health and true love is, you know, their challenge. The beast within is what that how that beast within can be transformed, tamed, is really the whole message of Crimes of Grindelwald. Rowling has said flat out, these stories are not really about the crazy magical beast that Newt carries around in his case, as it is about our fallen nature, I think, essentially, and whether we can be redeemed or not, whether we can actually, you know, be good people rather than, you know, the evil folks of Grindelwald, who is evil through and through, but puts up a great front so that he seduces people. That to me is the big connection, is this beast within and redemption between the two stories.
Well, the biggest connection I saw was the devaluation of women in these upper class aristocratic families. You had the Lestrange family. You had their family tree that put the women as flowers. Mm-hmm. They did not have names. You know, they basically have two jobs, which is one, to look pretty, and number two, to bear sons. And that's the only value they have. So you had the Chisel family, where Jasper Chisel prized this son he had, the son who was a complete monster. He dismisses these daughters, Izzy and Fizzy, who he names after Christmas elves, apparently, and, you know, doesn't appreciate particularly the work Izzy does from him. But then you also see Charlotte, who is pregnant with the twins, and says, I think she says this twice, that the family they're thrilled about the boy. So she, who doesn't want kids, is now pregnant. She's producing the heir that this Ross family now is going to have. Interestingly, when you think about it, she's in her late 30s. She's pregnant with twins. she probably had infertility treatments. She really, in some ways, we may be seeing her as kind of a broodmare here, being coerced into having these children that she doesn't want, and that she's telling Cormoran, I'm leaving as soon as they're born because I don't want these kids in my life, and she's going to leave this little boy and this little girl with this family who is, quote, thrilled about the boy. That sounds a lot like the Lestrange family, with Lestrange not loving his daughter, but putting this great value on the son that he has, who of course ultimately meets a very tragic end. But so I thought that was an interesting connection, because you don't think about that happening in modern times. But and I have no idea if this is still a thing among British aristocrats, that they still want that
verdict. Yeah, it's still a thing. It's still a thing. Okay. Of the way in which women inherit the title, it changes.
Okay. Well, yeah. I was going to say Chisel leaves all of his goods.
Americans aren't really familiar with, so it's good to have a British perspective on that.
Chisel leaves the inheritance to the grandson, the 10-year-old.
Yeah,
Pringle. And not to the adult daughters.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I had written that one down too. There's still this very old-fashioned focus on the men, and this dismissing of women as, good for looking pretty and having babies, and those babies better be male, by the way.
Now, the Cormoran Strike series, unlike Fantastic Beasts series, has not developed the fan base. It's not, the Harry Potter fans have not moved with Cormoran Strike the way they have to Fantastic Beasts. So how can we explain the case of the missing fandom for Cormoran Strike?
Well, this is the answer I always give to this question, and I know not everyone agrees with this, but I've done multiple studies on fandom bases with surveys. I've done Hunger Games fans, I've done Harry Potter fans, I've done Divergent fans. Two things I always ask is, one, I ask the person's age, and number two, I ask how many times they have read the book. And this very consistent pattern is that the younger readers are the ones who reread the books multiple times. The older readers, even if they're on these fan sites, finding my surveys, caring enough about the books to take the surveys, are reporting very often that they have not read the books. They may have read them twice, three times, but you don't see it nearly as many saying, oh, I've read them, five plus times. So I've been hearing this in some of the critiques, even among very strong fans of Crimes of Grindelwald, that you have to see it at least twice to catch everything, and you have to go back and read the script because you miss so much the first time through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same thing is true for Cormoran Strike. You don't catch on to all this stuff, all this rich understory, undercurrent, on your first reading through. And I think because these books are targeted toward adults, because they are very much perceived as being in this genre of the murder mystery, that a lot of people, even the ones who are picking these up and reading them, are saying, okay, I've read it, I know who done it, great, I'm going to put it aside and go read something else. They're not doing the same level. I don't think Cormoran Strike readers are doing the same level of rereading that they did with Harry Potter when they were young. How many people had read Deathly Hallows three or four times by the time it had been out 2 months? How many people have read Lethal White four times? It's probably John.
I'm up to eight.
Oh, my.
Okay. My guess is, if this was Goblet of Fire, you'd have 1,000 fans you could discuss that book with that have also read it eight times by now, and you're just not going to find them because
the adults
that this genre of book is targeted toward are not the type that reread, and that is what's one of the things that is both so wonderful about J.K. Rowling's work and so frustrated in some ways about it, because you do have to re-experience it to unpack all the stuff. And unfortunately, I don't think many people are doing the extensive, deep, and repeated readings of Cormoran Strike.
I think, Louise, that's very, very wise, because, you know, I was thinking about all the things we've been talking about in this conversation, and you're not getting those the first time you read it. I started with first impressions, you know, and we had, you know, oh, you know, it was delightful. I was glad to see this, glad to see that. But then the deeper things, they require the rereading. They require reading the books J.K. Rowling is pointing you to read so that you can bring them in, and the mythology, and really kind of getting into it. And, you know, maybe because it's, you know, it's targeted to that adult audience, it's not getting that same level of attention. Bea, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think, you know, she has made a real desire to separate it by writing it under a different name. Mm-hmm. And it's worked. Now, most people wouldn't want a smaller audience for their work. it's very unusual to do that, but I think that is genuinely what she wants. I think she wants to start again with a different set of people who are not coming with you know, Harry Potter glasses on, as it were. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely worked. There's definitely people out there who enjoy Robert Galbraith and don't like Harry Potter. So in that sense, you start with a new set of people. But it does seem that the reciprocal thing is happening, and that people... I gave a talk to the Oxford University Harry Potter Society a few weeks ago, and I was making a connection with Silkworm, and I said, you know, who here has read it? And it was just me. I was the only person in the room who'd read Silkworm. And I thought, right, okay, this is, you know, and this is obviously a very adult and literary group of people, and they just hadn't thought, because I like Harry Potter, I'll enjoy Strike. So,
and the funniest thing about that, I'm going to disagree with you, B, just to show that we're not that good of friends here.
It's not what it shows, John.
No, the Rowling is disguising she's not playing the J.K. Rowling Harry Potter card, because so much of this book series is a commentary on the first thing. If she really had Harry Potter fandom hooked into this series, they would know that it was going to be a 7-book series, and they would see all these parallels and be talking about them. That's to tip her hand too openly. But really, a large part of this is to depend that you don't get the Harry Potter connections. And to do that, you just can't have the mass of Harry Potter fandom. If you follow Crimes of Grindelwald fandom online, it is global. It is manic to the point of being frenetic. There's nothing like that in Robert Galbraith's fandom. You know, there's just nothing like it at all. If there were, then a lot of these things would have already been figured out. I mean, the four of us are working on this series of books, but very few others are. For me, the big difference between the books is the most obvious one, right? There's no magic. I had a friend at work. He was a big Harry Potter fan. He had a very excited Harry Potter fan. Grew up with the books, reread them multiple times, reading them in Spanish now to improve his Spanish. And he said to me, I was urging him. I gave him copies of the books, you know, read Cormoran Strike. And he said, John, there's just no magic. And quite literally, that's true. There's no wand play type thing. But there's also there's not what the formalists call defamiliarization. You know, this is a very real, even with all the mythic references and you know, the unlikelihood of the story. I mean, that's probably what the biggest parallel between Goblet and this one is. I think B, you told me this. You know, that in Goblet, you know, Party Crouch could have just, you know, given Harry a teacup portkey in the beginning of the book and taken him right to the graveyard, and the story's over. And the same thing is true with Lethal White. You know, just steal the doggone painting, you idiot. You know, just take the thing off the wall and sell it, you know. But besides that, you know, bizarre storytelling, artificial, you know, draw into the story, there's nothing that really forces you to escape the world as you understand it. There's no re-enchantment. There's nothing that makes you abandon your mundane secular worldview quite like the escape from Privet Drive, to platform 9 3/4. There's no giant world difference where you're entering into a magical, wonderful, exciting place where things have different rules and such. Strike's world is relatively mundane, and people won't escape there for this. The goal is a transformed vision, so you see things with penetration, as Austin and Dickens like to say. You get that in any kind of detective story because you're trying to see through the narratives people are trying to deceive you with, but you don't get the great defamiliarizing experience of the magic and the world within the world that you get in Harry Potter. And that's what people really love about Harry Potter. They're not as excited about the complexity of the story and the Nabokovian craftsmanship of the books that are in both series. They want some magic, and it ain't there.
Yeah, and I think some of those magic elements and the escape part, and there's also a lot of humor, I think, in the Harry Potter books too. And there's humor in Cormoran Strike, but it's dark humor. You know, it's more cynical.
The celebration of friendship happens in both of them, and I do think, you know, Strike and Robin, when they're together, and there's sort of two or three bits where you just get them alone discussing the case, and I think there is really real humor in those bits, and you think, oh yeah, I recognize this.
Yes, but it does, some of the, you know, the enchanting parts of the magical world of, you know, the wizarding world does make some of the darker parts of it go down a little easier, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You don't have quite the same alleviating effect in the Cormoran Strike series.
Yeah, that humor point's very good. Almost every spell makes a reader chuckle. Mm-hmm. There's no equivalent in Cormoran Strike. Maybe the names are funny and meaning laden. I mean, I confess I laughed out loud when they arrive at the Dell in the house and they look through the window and they see a coffee mug that has Johnny Cash on it. That's a reference to the villain in Tiger in the Smoke, and that's just a funny little jewel Easter egg for, you know, serious J.K. Rowling fans who know that that's one of her favorite books. But it's not something that makes most Harry Potter fans laugh out loud. Johnny Cash mug, you know, that's not like, you know, the funny spell that you know, or the fake wands that Fred and George are selling. You know, there's no Fred and George inside this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember there was one part that I had to laugh out loud about. It was when Robin was telling Cormoran about her breakup with Matthew, and she said something about
you're no Sarah Shadlock.
No, it was her telling Cormoran, you know, some of the abusive things that that Matthew had said to her, and he thinks he told you that, huh? And says, imagining a few corrective procedures for which he thought Matthew might benefit. And that was such a Rowling-esque line, and it was just who wouldn't want to imagine, you know, Cormoran correcting Matthew with a few of his, you know, ex-military procedures. Going to happen. He's not going to go beat up the guy for her. But even though, but just that little glimpse into his mind and that sort of fantasy about him going and really pounding the guy for her, it is something just quite satisfying. It's like one of those moments where you see Neville slice off the head of the snake or Molly Weasley take out Bellatrix. You just, yeah, finally.
Yeah.
You know, that,
and I,
Louise,
I the stuff, but you can't have it realized. I mean,
you're wrong. I think if you look at book one and how it finishes, and you look at the line you've just pulled from book four, that a possible, if not probable, ending of book seven is a fight between Cormoran and Matt in which, his head is bloodied, you know, turned into that big red head in the finish.
Whose head, Matthew's or Cormoran's?
Matthew's. I don't see the X boxer losing that battle.
I don't know. I mean, in this, you know, in the fantasy world, you can have some of this. Of course, you know, it's this one, the Equalizer. It's you know, Harry can pull off a brief Cruciatus curse on a Caro, even though it's unforgivable. I mean, that was basically just sort of a good equivalent of a wizarding punch in the nose, and you know he had just spit in McGonagall's face, and of course you've got to punch him in the nose for that. But you know, in a more realistic setting, I mean, realistically, and I'm trying to envision this on string. If you had, if you physically saw a guy as big as Cormoran is supposed to be beating up on Matthew, who is, you know, probably reasonably athletic, but he's no giant. It's not going to look heroic. It's going to look bullying. You know, you pick on someone your own size, and there is no one Cormoran's size, so he can't really pick on anyone his own size.
We'll have to give Matthew a weapon or something.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's just going to happen.
I think this fantasy of Cormoran knocking the guy out is, you know, it has to remain imaginary for it to be enjoyable to us.
Otherwise,
so
it's too real.
That's part of the difference between the realistic and the fantasy. Whereas, you know, in Harry Potter, you can have, you know, like I said, Harry crucioing Caro after he spits in McGonagall's face, and it works because he's a kid and he's an adult and he's good, and the guy is clearly quite evil, and you know, you can have these inversions and these physical defenses of the good guys in a way that you can't necessarily do with Cormoran Strike.
Well, I hate to say this, everybody, but we are out of time. But what a great conversation. I think I hope that maybe some of our listeners who are readers of Cormoran Strike have been affirmed that there are lots of connections among all of the different things that Rowling has been writing. And if you're a Harry Potter fan who's reading Cormoran Strike, I think we can now see some added insight into what she's doing in her latest book series. So let me thank our guests. Thank you so much, Louise Freeman and Beatrice Groves, for being on the podcast today and helping us to understand more about Lethal White and the Cormoran Strike series. Thank you, John Granger, for being our continuing expert guest. And I know that our listeners are going to want to keep going back to HogwartsProfessor.com for all the latest information as you are mapping out the Cormoran Strike series and the Fantastic Beasts, Crimes of Grindelwald movie, which you've been writing a lot about as well.
Yeah, we're working on that. And I'm going to do a series of videos, 3 or 4 videos on the things you have to know about J.K. Rowling to get Crimes of Grindelwald.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm seeing a lot of crazy speculation and such about things like the alchemy, where people just don't get how Rowling works alchemy. There's things about the mythic side to it that they're and the whole formalist thing. They don't get Rowling's works, and they're trying to figure out where these movies are going without that backdrop. You also see the same problem in reviewers who are really disappointed in the second movie because it's not a standalone movie.
Right.
Well, Rowling doesn't write anything that was a standalone since Casual Vacancy, and thank God she hasn't tried to repeat that adventure.
But John, how wonderful that, because I feel like you really are in J.K. Rowling's head. You kind of have a sense of her process, how she works, how she thinks, and for you to be able to share that through these videos about the Fantastic Beasts movies, that's going to be something I think people are going to want to tune into.
I blush that you say that with B. Groves, who goes to the actual place where, you know, the characters are eating while she's reading the scene. I don't feel like I'm quite in the head yet, but I look over B's shoulder, who's looking over the presence's shoulder.
Nah, thank you, Jen.
Well, thanks also to Emma Nicholson, who is our technical editor in Australia. Thank you for everything that you do to make us sound good, Emma. As always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, and they've also been publishing a lot of interesting things about the Fantastic Beasts series, particularly. Dear listeners, we are so glad that you joined us today, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And now, listeners, I leave you with the wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time, when we'll be using our words to make some magic.